Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Aaron Bresnitz. Hope everyone out there is staying safe, staying sane, taking care of yourself, taking care of each other. It's almost fall here. The sweaters are being unpacked. The rain is starting to fall. Even here in Los Angeles, we have some gray skies. It is very cozy times. We are honored to be sitting down with Alex Fanouf and Or Amsalam, the co-owners and operators of Lodge Bread Company, Foolproof Pizza, and Hasiba. We talk about their journey into making bread in their backyards, the rise of bread culture in Los Angeles, and expanding into pizza and hummus, and how they've become a neighborhood shop for all things carbohydrates. It's really great, really fun, really great look into partnership and relationships from two guys who just love bread. And then we dig into the archives to hear a great R&B, jazz, pop, special blend of music from the one and only Mia Gladstone. It's a really great, just fun, Sunday, easily listening music. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Baby, I grow like a flower. Baby, I grow like a flower. I'm like the sweetest of sour. I got the flow like a shower. Come pick my brain for an hour. Finical love or power. I hold my ground like a tower. Cynical, I empower. I came to stay, I'm no coward. I'm so divine like universal love. Oh, oh, oh. I'm so divine like universal. I get bigger and stronger, da-ba-dee-da-ba-da-dee-do. I fear my passion, no other, couldn't lose, I'm a lover. I tell the truth, but I stutter, know what to choose, I don't hover. Na-na-na-no-no-no, oh yeah, yeah. Na-na-na-na-na-no, I'm so divine. So divine, just close your eyes, expose your light.
Alex and Or, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you so much for, you know what, I won't even say you're taking time out from work. I assume that you have massive amounts of loaves just proofing and rising. So you're like fitting us in to your yeah, very busy day.
The ship wouldn't sink if we were away from it for a minute, so no worries.
That You know, I'm a fan of your bread. I'm a fan of what you guys have been doing over the years. And what I love about your story, it's so interesting because it's played out so much in the last year and a half of people realizing they had a side passion or a hustle, even working within the food business. Like, oh, I really like doing this. But that was actually your original story of how you got started back in 2014, 2015. What drew you to bread, especially during that time in LA? Because even that now is like such a standard thing. Like, oh, I make great bread in LA, but you know, 7-8 years ago, not so much.
Alex, you want to take this one?
I can take this one. Yeah, there was some half decent bread floating around, but you're right, there weren't any notable brick and mortars like we had in other parts of the country. Obviously the bigger cities, San Francisco had them for quite some time, and New York had them for quite some time, and the South was kind of popping off, and North Carolina had already kind of had a couple great bakeries open that some eyes were on in the baking scene. But Orr and I were still in a bit of a rut with chef jobs when we met, and we were a bit burnt out. That obviously was a ways before the pandemic, but you know, we've gone through a couple troughs in the food service industry, post 9/11 hurt, and then the economic disaster of 2008 really hurt, but we had stuff kind of popping up. 2007 fine dining kind of died. I mean, there was some stuff that happened in our time, in our cooking careers, that had already been a little bit of bruisers. So we were a bit burnt out. I think when we met in 2014, we were kind of at a dead end job. Or had started making bread at home, and he said, oh, we should make bread at work, via a couple serendipitous occurrences. Like, he had gone to Israel to see some family and left his starter with me to feed, which is a little bit of a bait and switch, because obviously he came back and was like, yeah, oh, well, the starter's at work, we might as well make bread here. But we started making bread at a little dive that we were working at, and the bread, it was kind of a nice avenue to put new dishes on the menu with bread, you know, tartine this or a side of bread. It was just kind of like, out of boredom and lack of things to put on the menu, that we're like, this would be awesome to have on the menu. But the loaf started selling outright whole from the front of the restaurant, but with no fancy facade, no pop-up, no bread display, nothing like that. So it kind of stemmed from just is that you breathing into the mic, or is that someone else? Wind? Gustiness?
That's not.
It was always heavy breathing. It's fine. And yeah, so we were like, wow, this bread's selling, and we don't have to work these crummy line cook jobs, as it seems, if this bread just sells. Mm-hmm. So we quit our jobs. And they weren't huge jobs to quit, you know, but it was a little scroungy back then. The jobs weren't great. I mean, even the chef jobs weren't great that I remember in 2014, but you know, all the complaints that have come up nowadays and the things that have come to light, they were things we were living with for decades, right? It's not like you were going to leave, like, you never had like a super high paying chef job even. So it didn't take too much of a nudge for us to be like, well, we can quit our jobs and just try to do something. But as things progressed and we kind of lined some things up, the ideas changed, the ideas were modified.
Right, because it's one thing to make bread out of your backyard and sell a couple loaves. It's quite another thing to turn it into a business. What were the steps that you took to make it something real?
Yeah, we did sell bread out of the backyard. When we started the business, we set up a pretty bootleg bakery in Alex's backyard under a carport. We ran gas lines exposed. We ran water lines, set up an oven and a kitchen sink, and we were selling bread to, I think, like 8 local restaurants pretty notable ones too. Like our friends were chefing at, and nobody really knew where it was coming from, and we didn't want to tell anybody where it was coming from. And yeah, it was wild. So yeah, people definitely questioned us for a little bit because they didn't know where the bread was coming from.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of backyard baking and selling it to be an actual restaurant, again, normal today, but crazy back then. Were you making all of your connects through just word of mouth or other people who knew the industry? Or was it just, hey, I'm going to drop off a couple of loaves? Like, what was the sort of that early day hustle grind to get your bread out into the world?
We had several friends, like I said, that were running restaurants at the time. So that really helped. And then we kind of, not really cold call, but we would take bread to restaurants and just do tastings with chefs, and everybody loved the bread. So, you know, it was pretty easy.
It was full grind. I mean, it wasn't like, we thought there might be a few handouts, but even our like chef buds that were really running places, I mean, it was like there wasn't a whole lot of trust there. It was like, well, you're gonna have to come in and do a full length tasting. And I mean, it was a grind. I mean, to go in with like every single loaf, you know, we could possibly bake and not screw it up, and then pull off a tasting and then pull off consistency. And we were baking 7 days a week, and so it was kind of, there wasn't, I don't really remember there being much leeway. And sometimes we would totally screw it up, or sometimes we'd totally cancel, or, I mean, it was a grind to get like a dozen clients. But most of them stuck with us for quite some time. To get back to your original question though, when we originally discussed it, I think in a perfect world, or if things had lined up, in a different way, which I think we're both glad it didn't. We really thought, okay, we want to leave this restaurant, and we like bread, and we want to open up our own place together. We think we'd make a good team.
Right.
We did land on bread cafe breakfast spot. We narrowed it down to that just out of like, we thought, well, there's only so much money we could pull scrounge together. Like, we can't go open a restaurant. We had been doing that. We knew what that costs. It was astronomical in our minds. And we just kind of thought like, where do we go? We got to make money. We got to be smart about it. We got to attack something with good margins. You know, we knew we couldn't like kind of do a random food pop-up. I mean, we did keep it focused in the bread world because we were passionate about it, but also it looked like a avenue for success. You know, we could keep it small enough. We could stay focused. It could be artisanal. We could find a little niche. But besides a couple mentors, you know, we didn't have too many people that were like, don't do this, do this. We just were kind of like, what's the path of least resistance to get our own place open? Brick and mortar, brick and mortar, brick and mortar, brick and mortar. You know, the whole time we were grinding in the backyard, we were, though unequipped financially, we were looking at places to lease from day one, kind of trying to attack that dream. So, you know, it wasn't so much like, let's do a bakery in the backyard and sell bread, period, and just kind of see where it goes. We were like, we don't want to be in this backyard, but let's definitely grind this out to kind of get the stepping stones moving in the right direction. But our minds were kind of in the way of like, let's do something. Let's get to a small cafe as fast as possible so we can try to open our own place. You know, brick and mortar was kind of on the burner the whole time.
I want to get to that jump from the backyard to brick and mortar in a second, but how did you two decide that you guys would be good partners together? Because essentially you decided to leave, albeit maybe not the most lucrative or dream job in the culinary space, but really take a risk. What made you trust each other to take that risk together?
We had known each other for what, only like 5 or 6 months before we decided to work together. Wow. Alex had just moved from San Francisco. I was kind of trying to open my own thing before that job, and I was doing some private chefing at the time. So I was like hungry for something else. And I think one day we had like a really annoying service, and I asked Alex, I was like, what do you want to do like in the future? He said he wanted to open a cafe, and I was just like, all right, let's do it. Let's do it. Quit your job. I'll quit my job and we'll make it happen. And I think it was like the next day he showed up at my house. He's like, I quit. So let's do it. So I was like, all right, great. I mean, we worked well in the kitchen, so we knew it would work. We were just tired of busting our ass for somebody else and not being able to enjoy our day to day, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I mean, look, baking bread is not easy. It's one thing to put up a loaf or two at home every once in a while, but to consistently put that out, which is in some cases the first taste of food that someone's going to get at a restaurant, that they're going to put that on the menu. What gave you that confidence? Because you're saying open up your dining experience with us. And, you know, when the feedback started coming in, because it sounds like there wasn't just a, hey, cool, you guys are selling bread. Like, how did you take those early days of feedback and go like, you don't know what you're talking about? Like, you actually are trying to help us get a better product.
Yeah, I mean, we got the early days of feedback at the restaurant that we were working at the time. I mean, we went through a lot of different stages of the bread. When it really clicked was when customers started buying bread from the kitchen before eating dinner. Or, you know, they would finish their dinner and they would come up to the pass and ask for if it was possible to buy a loaf of bread. We kind of started also making the menu over there very bread heavy. And you know, we tried to use the bread for any dish possible. So we were already, getting that feedback. And then we just, you know, decided to take that step and say, hey, we're going to just make bread for as many people as possible until we can open our own little cafe. I mean, and we had been cooking for a long time, so we were pretty confident in our product.
Listen, we're going to take a quick little break because I want to talk about going from backyard to brick and mortar, what you learned from that, what you continue with you today, and then eventually talk about Hasiba, Foolproof Pizza, and also some of the music that you like to listen to when you're just, you know, in that dough zone. We have another song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.org.
Thank you. about trust. It's about faith. It's about all the things I want, all the things you're not willing to say. So what you gonna say? Ooh, what you gonna say? It's about me. It's about you. It's about all the things I want, all the things you're not willing to do.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are with Alex and Orr, the co-owner operators of Lodge Bread Company. And before the break, you talked about from day one getting into a brick and mortar out of the backyard or out of someone else's, you know, restaurant. What was that jump? What made you finally feel confident to say we're going to take on a rent? We're going to take on a possible bad HVAC system. We're going to get these ovens that we're going to own. You know, what made you say like, all right, let's do this. Let's go all in. And did you feel that you had to at the time? Did you feel that like you couldn't keep just doing it out of your backyard or some just commissary that you really need to have a store for?
I mean, yeah, everything was starting to crumble in the backyard. We were a year in that backyard kitchen, and we not only were we falling apart, but the kitchen itself was falling apart. So I think it was a necessary change. We had been looking for a space for about 6 months, and I mean we were working with some pretty bougie real estate brokers that just did not want to listen to us when we said we didn't have a budget for a space in Silver Lake or a space in West Hollywood or, you know, a space in Beverly Hills. Like they were like pitching us these crazy locations that we just were like, there's no way. And we made the mistake of signing an exclusive with them. So we were stuck. At the time that we finally could get out of that deal, we just drove around and we found, you know, a small space that had like a little sign on it that said office for rent. It was it's the Culver City space that was about 2 minutes away from Alex's house at the time. And we called, we met the landlord. We thought it was perfect. The rent was perfect for us. And we just kind of went for it. We took a couple family loans. We built the space ourselves with like two or three other guys. And we got it open within like 4 or 5 months. And we were pretty nervous. We did not, you know, we didn't like have this like master plan. We just said, we're going to make some bread for some local restaurants. And if we get some retail and dine in, like, great, that'll be an additional, form of revenue for us. But we envisioned everything going out the back door and we envisioned doing a bunch of wholesale. But I mean, that quickly changed right when we opened the door. I mean, then we got inundated with locals and, you know, people who had been following us online. I mean, Alex, we had a pretty big following when we opened. We had like 10,000 followers online and when we had opened the shop just from our backyard bakery. I mean, if you want to.
Yeah. Yeah. We had some great people behind us. I mean, the backyard bakery was at, our architect's house. Not like a fancy house or anything by any means, but enough space for us to do it by Marina Del Rey. And they put together our plans for us. And, you know, we had like a great produce purveyor that had us on like ridiculous terms. And Nikki and Keith Giusto were like really guiding us in the right direction on getting flour. And, you know, there were like plenty of people that were like, kind of like, yo, if you guys are serious, like, they had our back. It felt like a lot of people had our back. So, you know, you can fail obviously at any time. And we did in a lot of ways, but we did have, we had told people, Hey, we're doing this. And so I was like, oh yeah, cool story. And then the next week you're like, hey, we're really doing this. Like we need two pallets of flour, and just be like, oh, okay. Yeah, guys, for sure. Like, what's going on? And then like call like the next week. It's like, no, we weren't, like, we want the flour right now at this address. Yeah. We're opening a place. Like, oh God. Okay. Like, I'll be there. Like, we used to like just get tons of visits and we were like heavily supported by some great mentorship, that I think also pushed us just to kind of keep going. Even though our head was in the sand some days, it was like, just keep going. Like, oh, you know, had a lot of like, I think it was just like right time, right place for like some of the people that were helping us out. And we didn't have like Orr said, like anything bougie. You know, we had like a really scrappy construction crew. Like, they just, I don't know, it was just kind of balls to the wall. It's like, oh, rip one of the walls out to shove an oven in and do this. Like, none of it was like well documented. Like, we weren't like trying to get famous on Instagram, like no videos, sure, like sure. No fancy this, no fancy that. It was just kind of like,
I mean, we spent
like
a
we
week
framed
doing
up the bathroom ourselves. Like,
all
yeah,
the
we
tile.
Did all the tile ourselves. Like, it was just like we didn't really have anything else to do or lose. So, you know, we were very like attached to the project. It was kind of like, I don't know, if somebody said like, do you think this is going to fail? We'd be like, how do you spell that? Like, we don't know. Like, which is just this, we're doing this and it's going to work. And if we have to stand in the place for 5 years, cause there's no customers, we'll just stand in the place for 5 years. And we really were, it was an operation that had 3 employees for the first 18 months. So it wasn't like, we had already done all the openings, you know, we had done all the openings for restaurant groups. We had done we'd done the big 350 seaters. We had done the 100 seaters. We'd done fine dining. We'd done the openings. We've been a part of places closing. You know, we had a pretty big repertoire of, okay, how do we bare bones this? How do we bootstrap every single thing so that if the bootstrap fails, it doesn't fall far. It's not a hard fall if a smaller purchase fails. Like, rather fail on a few small purchases than fail on just one gigantic one. Then again, you know, I think we were paying stuff back and going into debt and putting stuff on credit cards for a year. You know, it wasn't like we really bootstrapped every single thing.
Don't do that. So.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. A lot of stuff we still bootstrap, but like we were opening our first place.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, the great thing about having a bakery is that it becomes a staple in someone's life. It's like, this is the place where we get bread as a family. This is the place where we get pastries and things like that. And yeah. It sounds like you've, from the get-go, at least ingratiated yourself to the community. That has got to help, because, you know, there's some meals or some places that I love, but I go, I'm not eating there every week. I'm not going there every week. But you guys have a loyal following. But you've also seen the perception of bread and bread making and what can be like that in LA grow at the same time you've grown your business. How have you seen that ingratiation to community and the growth of bread perception in LA, you know, grow together at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, we've always been very, very community minded. I mean, we are always at the restaurant, you know, from day one, and all the locals, you know, were very friendly, and we wanted to make a good relationship because, you know, we were serving that community. We didn't want to pretend to be, you know, like I said, some bougie West Hollywood bakery in West Culver City. We cater to our community. I mean, no matter where we go. So whether it's the music we play or the items we offered on the menu, I mean, when we opened, we only had like 5 toasts on the menu and a couple pastries. It wasn't like the menu that we have now, but yeah, I mean, I think it was just the atmosphere that we created that was very welcoming to anyone. And everybody was very interested. Yeah. Like you said, in bread at the time. So it was, I think, the right time for us to open that bakery, because yeah, bread has just become like this new big thing, and people got to watch us make bread. They got to watch us bake the bread. I mean, it was open the kitchen was completely open. You could see every aspect of the process. So that was also a big drawing factor for people. They could sit down, have a toast, and, you know, watch Alex and I shape bread for 45 minutes. So I think that was also a big part in the success. The vibe was very crucial to our success. I mean, we played loud music. We yelled at each other and customers sometimes. So, you know, it was like a fun experience for people.
What was the soundtrack?
Lots of reggae.
Lots of reggae at first. A lot of the Dead. Mostly a lot of reggae at first. I mean, we were there from like 2 a.m. until 8 p.m. So it was basically what we could listen to all day without wanting to kill each other.
I was going to say it was kind of like an old, like kind of like an old school vibe. I mean, I think I'm sure somebody could check us at any point that, you know, there's been times where we're not like the most humble, but I think we had humble roots because it's all we really had. We were exhausted every single day. And it was almost like walking by an old school restaurant anywhere in the world. Like, you know, I think if customers walked in the back way, because you know, our parking lot's open, like Orr and I were probably smoking out back. Like we weren't like, we looked like we were like totally defeated almost every day and exhausted. And if we weren't smoking a bowl out back, we were smoking cigarettes out back and like waving to customers. Like we didn't really have much of a persona. Like it was just kind of like, hey, like we're exhausted and we're working, and like if you stop in our cafe and grab something, great, but like we're just kind of like, we probably just kind of look like dirtbags and smell like cigarettes for at least the first year. Like I guess that going back to the point of like the locals, like we weren't trying to be anything beyond just like, I don't know, like playing like blue collar folk in a way. Like we were just kind of like, hey, we're grinding it out here. We got nothing to hide. Like there's no fancy facade. Like I don't think anybody came in our business in the first year and thought like, oh, these guys have endless budget and like they're trying to be way too fancy and this is beyond gentrified. And I mean, we already knew we were like coming into a very old, you know, a neighborhood that had been around forever. It had gone through many iterations. I mean, a bunch of the stuff on that block that we were used to kind of stopping at or checking out 10 years before had been bulldozed. And it was kind of like dirt lots around us and stuff, kind of like you could tell stuff was like about to be bought and sold. And it was kind of a time when the neighborhood was changing a little bit. But our space, I think our little space was still scrappy and we were really scrappy. So I don't think we didn't really have much to represent other than the raw versions of ourselves. So I think our local clientele really latched to that, to a degree or in a pretty big way. 'Cause it was all we had to offer. We didn't have anything fancy to offer in essence. You know, we didn't open with a big menu and open with a big drink menu. And we just didn't, we didn't have the capability. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we had like, I don't think anybody could say like, we came out swinging, trying to be like disingenuous in any way. We were just like, we were who we were.
Amazing. Well, you've expanded since then, though. You have Hasiba, and now you have Foolproof Pizza. What finally made you want to get, I don't know if I want to say a little bit more fancy, but do something a little bit more traditional offering as far as not just a bakery, but as far as food service, restaurant vibes, things like that. When did you feel confident to expand, and what made you want to go in these two directions?
Well, when we first expanded Lodge to be more of like a two-meal cafe rather than just a bakery that offered a couple toasts, that happened before anything. That happened like a year and change after we opened. We took the space that was connected to our space. Our neighbors left and we jumped on the opportunity to snag it just because – you know, we are chefs originally, and so we thought adding a food aspect would definitely be beneficial to us and the neighborhood and the community. And then once we did that, we had several other opportunities come up. Hasiba was a failing restaurant at the time, and one of my father's friends was the landlord, so he approached us about taking the space, and it just wasn't the right kind of space for a bakery. at the time. So we decided to open a hummus falafel shop, which was something that we've always wanted to do because we were making hummus and pita at the time. So we figured, why not just,
sure,
you know, honor my family. We named it after my grandma, and we just, you know, opened a small hummus restaurant. It was just kind of like it wasn't like a planned thing. It was just an opportunity that came up that we just went with. And then Foolproof was based off of our, I don't know if you're familiar, but when we opened, we had a pizza night every Sunday, and it was,
No, I remember.
Yeah. So it was pizzas baked out of our deck oven. So they were a lot different than a Neapolitan style pizza. It was like a crispy bottom pizza. When we expanded, we started doing Neapolitan. So Alex and I both really missed that other style of pizza. And we said, once we moved all of our baking into our commissary facility, we'll start making pizza out of that oven again. And so that's how Foolproof kind of was born. And now with the pandemic and everything, there's a lot more opportunities. So we took over a couple of second gen restaurants, and we're going to be opening them hopefully in the coming months. We have a couple Foolproof pizzas in the works.
You know, I got to ask, because the parallels between a bakery becoming someone's go-to place every week. Pizza is one of those places where you could order that for yourself or for the family every week. What's the goal or the plan to get people to make Foolproof their weekly pizza spot?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the goal, right? You want, we've worked in so many restaurants, and we've seen what works and what doesn't work, you know, and we're very aware of the fact that people in LA especially are not going and eating at fine dining establishments every week, twice a week, three times a week. They come to, you know, No Frills eateries several times a week. That's what they make their regular spot, like a bakery or a cafe or a pizza shop. So that's how we want to grow our business, and that's how we feel like we will be more successful. I mean, we could easily open, you know, a dinner only higher end establishment, but it just doesn't really fit our model. We want to do something that people can come and enjoy multiple times a week, and that's just, you know, I mean, Alex is,
yeah. To center Orr's explanation into an answer form, the pizza places, the Foolproofs, are going to harken back to like less of a like, look at how badass my pizza is. We just want it to be the best pizza possible and hyper approachable. Like, the bigger spots are going to have arcade games in them. They're going to be bring your family, bring the kids. And get a bunch of pies for your birthday party, or come after school and grab a slice. Like, very family friendly, very like old school, like back to our childhood pizza spot, and kept simple and fun. Not trying to like go overboard with like the craziest, most unique, named after something or another pizza game. Like, just, this is a great pepperoni pizza. That's it. So we're hoping that you know, that's the vision that comes to life for the pizza spots.
We just want to make good food that people enjoy, our families enjoy.
Amazing. Well, listen, guys, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to sit down and chat with me. If people want to check out any of the restaurants, where can they go? Where can they find more info? Where can they order?
Yeah, so you can go to lodgebread.com, or what is the
Foolproofpizza.com.
Foolproofpizza.com.
HasibaRestaurant.com.
Or on Instagram, yeah.
Yeah, Instagram. Or search any of the delivery apps.
Yeah, we're all over.
We're on all the normal stuff. Amazing. If you can't, eat at Lodgebread is the most popular email to send questions to.
Amazing. Well, listen, thank you guys. Congratulations. Looking
thank
forward
you
to having some more pizza and hummus and bread with you guys, because it's just so good. We have another song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes, and then a live performance on HRN.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. This is Jeet. I am here in the studio with Mia Gladstone. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you so much.
How was it getting here? I heard the L train was a bit of a bitch.
Yeah. Are we allowed to curse on here?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it was really annoying. I thought I left enough time because I got to Penn Station super early, and then I got to the train and it was like, it'll be here in 20 minutes.
Oh, where are you coming from?
I come from Jersey.
Oh, okay. Yeah, me too.
Where?
Jersey City.
Okay, yeah. So you're more at a more communable place. I'm in South Orange, so
transit. Wait, you got to get to, New Jersey Transit to Penn Station.
It's so annoying, yeah, and then...
Oh my God, how annoying.
Yeah, but it's it's just short enough to still be doable, but long enough to be the most annoying, most repetitive thing in the world.
But you're here.
I'm here.
And that's what's important.
Yes.
So how'd you get into music?
I've been doing music forever. It's just innate within me. It's my number one thing that I do.
Were you around musical family members or?
Yeah. My dad, I guess I just grew up surrounded by music. It was it was always something that we were listening to. And
like, what kind of music?
Well, my dad, like all kinds. My dad really liked like classic rock, like suburban white dad. Like
all dads do.
This is like the classic rock. And then my mom really liked Kanye, and she liked more of the hip hop kind of stuff.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, it was a very interesting mix. And then I guess like I kind of found my style because my dad gave me an MP3 player when I was like six, and he just loaded hundreds of songs onto it.
Yeah.
And I gravitated towards like Stevie Wonder, Lauryn Hill, Steely Dan.
Nice.
Like David Bowie.
That's pretty eclectic.
Yeah, it's like all over the place.
So how did you get from listening to all these different kinds of influences and then starting to write your own music? Like, where did that start?
Well, I started writing music when I was like six or seven.
Wow, that's young.
It was, yeah. Well, because I asked my dad to teach me piano when I was seven. And so he didn't know how to play piano.
Wait, do your parents play music at all?
My dad always played guitar growing up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I asked him to teach me piano or get me piano lessons. And he's like, well, I don't really want to pay for lessons. So I'm going to learn piano myself. And I'm going to teach you. So he like learned piano online, and then he just taught me. And I don't know how to read music or anything. Like, I kind of just learned the notes and the
chords.
That's
a pretty kick-ass dad.
Pretty kick-ass. Yeah, I'm so grateful because it was awesome. And like the second I was able to play piano, like chords and stuff, that's like when I was able to actually put all my ideas into song. So yeah, around when I was seven, I guess.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah.
So you get into music at around six or seven, and you start writing music around that time too?
Yeah, because so in second grade, like I had this school talent show, and I was like, I guess I'm just going to play a song and sing on piano. And like, I didn't know what I was going to play, but then I just ended up writing a song, and that's what I performed.
an original composition?
Yeah.
For a talent show? That's amazing.
Yeah, and then it just became this thing that every year I would do the talent show, and I'd always have songs for that. So it was like a big motivator in writing
music. So when did you
start
recording these ideas?
Recording, I think the first time I really recorded was when I was in fifth grade.
Because
My dad, he had like a recording setup and stuff.
Oh my
at
god,
home.
Your dad is like
my dad is my
all around engineer.
Helped me so much. He engineered the session. Oh my god,
that's amazing.
It's so cringy though when I look back on it because I heard the recording many years later and my voice was so like shrill and undeveloped, obviously as like a fifth grader, but it's like still on the harmonies and stacks that I do now, a little kid voice.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was a lot, but
it really laid the foundation, I assume.
It really did, yeah. Like I was like, wow, I can. And also I think it was back in the day, like it wasn't like I would record an idea like bit by bit. It was like I had to write the whole song before I would record. Versus now, like my process is very broken up. Like I'll start with the beat, I'll do a little bit of the beat, I'll do some vocals over it, and I'll like build off of it little by little. So I feel like having that foundation of the discipline of making the whole song was really good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I kind of want to get back to that because I feel like I was a better songwriter when I could just
do
that.
Oh, that's fascinating. I definitely want to talk about that more, but let's move into a song.
Let's
what are you going
to
perform first for us?
Okay, so the first song I'm going to do is called My Tits Grow in the Winter.
Love the title.
Thank you. It's a song about body dysmorphia. And yeah, it's just a short little snippet.
When I'm talking to you, baby, can't you tell me how to feel? Da 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 ba da do, da 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 ba da do. Do you love me as much as you say? How do you really know what you mean? Baby, tell me what pops in your brain when you see the image of me in your face. Yeah, tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, my tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, yeah. I be looking in the mirror. There's this bitch, she's staring back. I never see her. I'm always so confused why she always seems to pop up in my view. I don't know her. Tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, my tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, yeah. Da 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 da. Da 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 da.
So let's talk about your new single, Geekin'.
Let's talk about it. Yeah, I dropped it super recently. It's a self-produced track.
So you did everything.
I did everything.
You made the beat.
I did.
You recorded your voice.
Mm-hmm. And I got my boy Cicero was featuring on it.
Wow, very cool.
Thank you. Yeah, that song, should I talk about how it like?
Yes, absolutely.
Together? Cool. Well, I made it for my Splice Pack originally.
Nice.
So I had to make like a sample beat for it. So the beat is also comprised of like my vocals. Mm-hmm. Like that's mm-hmm. what I sampled. And basically, I had to go to DC to record this video for Splice. And then my boy Cicero is from DC. So I was going to have him hop on the beat. And yeah, so we like did this whole thing, this whole video. And then I really liked how the song came out, but I kind of slept on it. And then maybe like 6 months later, I came across it and I was like, I should finish this song. So we just ended up finishing the song. And it was like a family production because it was recorded and engineered by Owen, who's at Beyond Studios in DC. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up mixing it at the end, too. And it was just like a DMV production, the whole thing, because we recorded it there, too.
Got it.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like what you were saying before, where the songwriting is kind of in pieces. And funny yeah. enough, for Splice, which is, if anybody doesn't know, is where you find beats,
yeah.
basically. But you said that you want to start trying to go back to writing full-fledged songs.
Well, yeah, just to challenge myself a little more, because in this like new era I'm in my career, I've been producing everything myself. Mm. And so it's become this thing where I'm like, okay, well, to get the bass line started, like I'll just make the beat mm-hmm. and then I'll do my part and then I'll be like, oh, I'll add this to the beat. Rather than like, it's not like I make the full beat first,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like it's a constant building block.
Do you feel
things.
Like anytime like it's too much to be able to have to do everything? Do you feel like there's too much on your shoulders?
No, well, not really, because it was like completely my choice to do this mm-hmm. because I wanted to kind of reverse the roles. And I found when I first got into the industry, I was like, oh, I guess now I'm just a singer and I'm going to have to like sing over beats that other people make and do all this shit. Mm. And then I realized I don't have to do that at all. And
I can take
control and take the power back. And It's been super empowering and rewarding to produce everything myself, and especially continuing to reverse the roles by like featuring rappers on my tracks that I produce. It feels really good.
It sounds like you are your father's daughter.
That I am.
That's amazing. That's really cool.
Thank you.
So did you said you make a you say you make a made a music video for this?
Yes.
The song?
Yeah.
So what was that process like?
Well, that was amazing. It hasn't come out yet. We're like, I'm super
Ooh, very excited.
Yeah. we shot it. It was, I'm trying to think, like, so it was originally supposed to be in one day, mm-hmm. like, and Cicero came from DC for this shoot.
Wow,
and then basically like last minute where we were supposed to film all this green screen stuff, they like flaked on us. And I had done this really elaborate makeup and I had so much shit with me.
Yeah.
And we had to reschedule it and Cicero had to go home. So I had to like bring him back the next week. And it was like, oh my God, it was so stressful. But now I'm so happy that we did it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because everybody around me was kind of like, I don't know if it's worth it for you to do a video for this song. Like it's so last minute. But I was like, nah, I'm doing the video. Like, it's going to be worth it. And now I'm seeing it paying off. Like, it feels really good.
And your videos are quite out there. I saw the Baby Don't Worry video.
Yeah.
Man, what was that like? The glitter. Oh, my God.
Glitter tits.
God.
Yeah, that was very intense. I don't know. Like, Yeah, I mean, I had done the full glitter body look before, so it wasn't my first time. But it was... I definitely made a mess. It was like a lot to clean up, a lot to put on, because you have to put like a layer of baby oil first over your skin and then glitter so that the glitter sticks, you know? So it's like,
I see.
A lot goes into
it. I'm not too familiar with glitter on the body.
I don't think most people are.
Yeah, it's not a very common thing.
But it was definitely fun. I didn't feel naked. Like okay. walking around, I was like, I feel like I'm wearing a bodysuit right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I feel great.
That's amazing. So what are you going to sing for us next?
Okay, next I'm going to sing a song called Don't Look At Me. And I wrote this song after a lot of frustrations being on the subway and people always staring at me when I'm just trying to mind my business and me just feeling like a target as a young woman.
Oh,
fresco. I can take 2 steps along the street without turning hella heads. I think they're onto me. I go about my business on the screen, but they yearning for my life information on she. It's a beautiful day, so I don't care that you can look away. And I'ma stay back, back and forth my body and your feet. Having trouble choosing between longing and your needs. You look me up and down like I'm a tree, thinking I don't see the way your fantasies unleash. I stare ahead so far away, so I don't meet your gaze. Beware of a lonely man. It's a beautiful day, so I don't care that you can look away. And I'ma stay back. Oh, I'm only young. Be careful when your mind travels unraveling your dignity and purity. Spare yourself the trouble, you ain't getting nowhere near my bubble. I'm not flattered, I'ma kick you to the rubble. Go about my day, my vision turns into a tunnel. I'ma live my life, cause it's a beautiful day. So I don't care that you can look away. And I'ma stay back.
Very cool.
I appreciate it.
So you just mentioned in the last segment that your next song, Geekin, is in the works.
The music video is in the works,
right? The song's done.
The song's out.
Mixed, mastered, out.
Uh-huh.
On Spotify.
Uh-huh.
Tidal.
All of the above.
All streaming services.
Yes.
It is available. When's the music video coming out?
We're not sure. I'm supposed to get a cut of it today.
Oh my God. That sounds exciting.
I'm so excited. I keep checking my email.
Have you, like, what's the big difference between the first cut and the final one? Like, from the music videos they've done in the past?
Oh my God. It's different for every video.
Is it like night and day, or is it like?
It really depends. It depends on who you're working with. Like, and it also depends on how clear the plan is going into it.
Yeah.
A lot of my videos were not very planned. So then, like, in the editing process, I have no idea what to expect, and I'll get it back and I'll be like, okay, I like this, don't like this, but I don't know. I think for the Geekin video, I'm really excited to see the first cut, and I have a feeling it'll be very close to the final cut.
Nice.
Because Jisun, who I'm working with on it, is just incredible, and like her editing skills are really,
she's the
really
director
cool.
or
she's a director, editor.
Shout out
Jisun. Yeah, she's amazing.
That's
awesome. It should be really cool.
So when that comes out, you'll probably do some shows?
Yeah, I have a show on Thursday, actually.
This Thursday?
On the 19th, yeah.
Whereabouts?
Market Hotel.
Market Hotel, you heard it here.
Heard it here first.
Awesome. Any other shows planned after that? Any tours?
Tours, definitely in 2020.
Nice.
To end 2019, I'm doing a show in New Jersey, my hometown, on the 30th. And then I have another show in like Montclair, which is right next to my hometown.
I love Montclair.
In January.
Oh my God, I love Montclair.
It's such a pretty town. Yeah.
If it wasn't so expensive, I would totally live there.
Yeah, it's really fucking expensive. But hey, they got really good vegan food, so.
So you're playing on the 30th of December? Wow, 2 days before New Year's.
I know. Amazing. And I'm going to Atlanta right before then. It's going to be really busy.
That's a wild, wild
it's
way to
wild.
Wild way to bring the new year in.
It is. Bring in the new decade. Can you believe
my
this?
God.
I keep tweaking about it when I think about it, I'm like, holy shit, it's 2020. We're about to be in the roaring
20s. 2020. Jeez.
We're going to thrive.
We are. We're going to
really
do well.
Excited.
We're all going to do well.
I think it's going to be the last 10 years that are like livable for humanity.
I don't think so.
I mean,
we'll be okay.
Yeah, we'll be fine. I don't know.
If certain things change, we'll be fine.
I guess we'll see.
How long have you been in the music industry per se now?
I guess I would consider like, well, I got out of high school like 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and that's when I like fully immerse myself in the industry.
Okay, so about 3 years, right?
It was 3 years, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, so are the things that you really like about it? And there are other things that you absolutely can't stand.
Should I talk about them?
Let's do the positive first.
The positive first, okay. Well, I really love all the collaboration and just the music community. It has been really incredible. Like, I keep finding myself having these bursts of gratitude where I'm like, wow, I'm surrounded by really amazing people who are like really pushing things forward. And people, I really like meeting people who aren't concerned about clout and all the bullshit that comes with being a musician, and people who just genuinely want to like connect as humans and make music. That's been really amazing, just who I've found myself surrounded by.
Yeah, those are there are people like that, and they're far and few, but when they're there, just clicks.
Exactly. Yeah, you meet somebody and you're like, I think I've known you forever.
Yeah, there's something so deep about whatever it is about music that really connects us. Like when you find that person, it's like you fall in love a little bit.
Yeah, no, totally. You know? That's also something I learned through music, that like being in love doesn't have to be a romantic thing. Like you can just be in love. Like I feel like I'm in love all the time because I just live in love.
That's
you
beautiful.
You know what I mean?
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, really let's switch it over. What do you not like? What would you like to change about the music?
Okay.
Industry?
Well, I would love all like the isms to go away, like the sexism within music, the racism, like just all the oppression that's within the industry. I found just as a woman, it's definitely been challenging. Like I have very different perspectives of people than like my male peers have. Like we'll be in a session with somebody, or like we'll know somebody in common, and they'll be like, oh yeah, he's such a cool dude, like we've made amazing music together. And I'll be like, oh, he like was extremely inappropriate with me and made me feel like an object. And it's just
going back to the Subway song, right?
Yeah, well, it's sad. It's like apparent in everything, but I think in music people really get away with it because it's such a casual industry. It's like because music, the music industry is like you're just living in the industry,
right?
So there's like really no boundaries. You know how in most industries it's like you don't combine business and pleasure. But music is business and pleasure.
Right.
So it's like
I would say entertainment industry. In
entertainment
general.
Industry, yeah, definitely. So it's a whole lot of like unprofessional people. And
so hopefully the next decade will be filled with more professionalism.
Yeah, and just being surrounded by more professionals.
More professionals who are in it for the music, not for the clout.
Yeah, and not for the sex.
In it for the love.
In it for the love. That's the most important thing. When you're moving with love, you don't have to worry about like offending people, and you don't have to worry about any of that shit, because it's all love.
Speaking of sharing love, is there anybody you want to shout out? Any other artists that
you're... Oh, God. Yeah, shout out to my parents. I record at home. Like I moved away from home for a bit, and then I've been back for a little while, and I'm like so grateful to my parents for allowing me to transform like this office in our crib like into my studio.
Big shout out to the parents out there. Much love.
Much love.
Where can people find you?
They can find me everywhere at Mia Gladstone.
Awesome.
Spotify, Apple, whatever, have it. Instagram, Twitter.
So easy. Mia Gladstone.
Mia Gladstone. Yeah.
Perfect. And with that, let's do the last song.
This is a song called Grow. Uh-huh. I produced this myself.
What's it about?
It is about growing, baby. It's about universal love and everything that fuels my heart.
Baby, I grow like a flower. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Baby, I grow like a flower. I'm like the sweetest of sour. I got the flow like a shower. Come pick my brain for an hour. Pinnacle of power. I hold my ground like a tower. Cynical, I empower. I came to stay. I'm no coward. I'm so divine like universal love. I'm so divine like you. I get bigger and stronger, da-ba-dee-da-ba-da-dee-do. I fear my passion, no other, couldn't lose, I'm a lover. I tell the truth, but I stutter, know what to choose, I don't hover. Na-na-na-no-no-no, oh yeah, yeah. Na-na-na-na-na-no, I'm so divine. Da do ba do ba da do da 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 do. My oh my, on my heels high, I rise above the sky, transcend this life. I'm so divine, like you. You're so divine, just close your eyes, expose your light.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Listening.